from KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell left gay and lesbian military families behind when it comes to benefits. One military spouse tells us why changing that policy is so important. And in the Salinas Valley, how one hospital is bridging a language barrier for Mexican immigrants who don't speak Spanish.
They are our future. We survive on the work that they do for us. We have to take care of them. It's more of a social responsibility.
Also, the most influential Grammy Award winner you've never heard of, and love on the beach, the mating behavior of elephant seals.
The alpha's strategy is to be dominant over a group of females, the harem, and they want to have the first kind of right to mate.
It's the California Report. We begin today with the limits of equality for gay service members. The end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell allows them to serve openly, but when it comes to hundreds of benefits most military families get, the spouses of gay and lesbian soldiers, Marines, and sailors are second-class citizens. Outgoing Defense Secretary Leon Panetta was reportedly going to extend more benefits to them this week, but that's now been pushed back. The Pentagon declined to comment or be interviewed, but a spokeswoman did tell the Washington Post they're reviewing the policy and what can be done in light of the Defense of Marriage Act, which prevents the federal government from extending benefits to same-sex couples. I talked with Lori Henzik of the American Military Partner Association. Her partner, Shayna, is a Marine Corps helicopter pilot stationed at Camp Pendleton in San Diego. I asked Henzik which benefits her group feels are most important.
Among our membership, we did an informal poll asking them, what are your, if you had to kind of say your top five needs? And the first one is military identification cards as family members. Same-sex spouses or domestic partners are currently denied military identification cards, which then grant them access to not only the base, but all of the facilities that are located on base. So it would grant them access to use of commissary or the base exchange facilities, which are effectively like a grocery store that is discounted on base. The second need was if somebody was to be moved to a duty station overseas. Unlike our heterosexual counterparts, our spouses are being denied sponsorship, which would allow them to have a financial allocation or a monetary allocation to help support the moving of that partner to join their partner on base. And the third was health care and insurance, which is somewhat straightforward. The fourth thing that we found was pay or housing allowances or travel. And this is basically the biggest financial component, the difference between tax-free housing allowances or tax-free bumps in pay based on your dependents or how many dependents you might have. And the last is particularly difficult, as there are many of our couples who are both members within the couple are active duty military. And so while our heterosexual counterparts are given preference to be stationed at the same duty station or at least nearby in the same geographical area, because same-sex marriage is not recognized, our families are given no consideration in this regard. This often splits up the family. This is further complicated by our service members who have children.
And as you said, some of these benefits are prohibited by the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. But I wonder if you think some of it is also like a lingering or even very strong resistance within the military culture that still judges same-sex military families to be not quite as deserving as other military families.
You know, I do hesitate to kind of pass judgment on what the culture may or may not be. And there's a lot of honorable traditions within all of the branches of the military. Certainly any change, particularly in an area where tradition is held of high regard, certainly it's going to be extremely difficult to adjust to the new modern military family and what that means or how it's defined. But I do want to point out that aside from, you know, us mentioning DOMA or the Defense of Marriage Act, and there are benefits that are regulated under the Department of Defense regulations that are currently unavailable to our same-sex military families, that while DOMA-allocated benefits are currently prohibited, the Department of Defense regulations could be actually changed without needing the repeal of DOMA, and these benefits could be extended to our same-sex military families. And those are the ones that Secretary Panetta has the ability to change.
If the Department of Defense extends these additional benefits, as is expected, what difference would it make to you and your partner in the short term? What would be the most immediate change you would feel?
I can speak for myself personally, and I will say it would definitely feel like we are regarded as equals, not only among Shayna's squadron, among the military branch she serves in, among the military service in general, but it sends a very strong message to the public that there are inequalities that can be righted and that same-sex couples are no different in terms of contribution to society. And I think that that's a very important message to send out to our service members and our military families.
That was Lori Henzik of the American Military Partner Association. In the Salinas Valley, small farm towns like Soledad and Greenfield dot Highway 101. Most farm workers there are from Mexico, and an increasing number are indigenous people from Oaxaca and other Mexican states. In fact, almost a quarter of all the indigenous Mexicans in California live in this region. They speak languages like Mixteco, Zapoteco, and Triqui. If they speak Spanish at all, it's a second language. That can create communication barriers in work, school, and healthcare. Reporter Lisa Morehouse visited the Salinas Valley and reports how one hospital is trying to serve them.
This is Petra León. She lives in Castroville and picks strawberries for a living, and she's one of more than 20,000 indigenous people from Mexico who live in the Salinas Valley. She says at the medical clinic closest to her, no one speaks her language, Mixteco, and she doesn't understand a lot of the things her doctor says. But here, at Natividad Medical Center in Salinas, León is joined by Angelica Isidro. She speaks Mixteco and Spanish and is a key part of the hospital's new language interpretation program. Petra León is pregnant, and she's planning on giving birth at Natividad. Dr. Peter Chandler shows her the labor and delivery unit.
So Petra, I'm Dr. Chandler. I'm the director of the unit here, and I'm just really happy you chose to have your baby here.
To bridge the language gap, there are two interpreters here, Mixteco speaker Angelica Isidro and language access coordinator Victor Sosa. He oversees all interpretation at Natividad. These four do a sort of language relay from English to Spanish to Mixteco and back again.
Gracias por saludarme. Me dio gusto saludarlos.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet you.
And today I wanted to show you the unit. We have a
As a safety net hospital, Natividad cares for patients regardless of their ability to pay. Indigenous Mexicans make up only about 2% of the hospital's patients. But Chandler says when he came here 6 years ago, every once in a while he'd be in an emergency situation with an indigenous patient with no way of communicating.
You can imagine how stressful that is. It really pushed us to say, you know, we need to do something.
Many hospitals will pull in people with language skills when they can, but what Natividad started a couple years ago is unique. They collected specific data about patients and language use. They made real ties with indigenous community leaders, and they gave indigenous speakers 40 hours of formal training and interpretation. Now they have a network of 35 trained indigenous interpreters and have 30 more people they can turn to in a pinch.
This is a typical room here. When you come in to deliver, the nurse will bring you in here. You'll find it's very
Chandler says interactions like this help build trust. He can answer any questions and address potential emergency situations like cesarean sections well ahead of delivery.
Thank you for letting me know that that happens when some women are not able to have their child.
Funding for the program comes from community and family foundations and from the area's successful farm families.
I've never even heard of some of these languages. Now I'm finding out that they're actually thousands of years old.
John D'Arrigo is a third-generation Salinas Valley farmer. Standing in his vineyard, he says there's a major labor shortage here, with the children of his farm workers aspiring to more lucrative jobs. He rallied other farmers to fund indigenous interpretation training and services.
They are our future. We survive on the work that they do for us. We have to take care of them. It's more of a social responsibility.
Because these indigenous languages are regional, when a patient comes to the hospital's registration office, they can point to where they're from on a map of Mexico, and staff can narrow down what language they might speak. But it can get even more complicated. Each language can have dozens of different dialects. Interpreter Angelica Isidro.
Cuando tuvieran una persona que dijeran el pueblo de donde eran y nosotros ya
teníamos. So when the patient was identified from a certain town, we had a pretty good idea of what dialect they spoke.
Victor Sosa says they found cultural interpretation to be as important as language. He remembers going to labor and delivery with an interpreter to check on a young Mixteco mother.
The nurse was worried that the mother was not bonding with the baby.
And was hesitant to discharge them. The new mom handed the baby back to the nurse as soon as she breastfed and didn't soothe the baby when she cried. The Mixteco interpreter stepped in to explain, saying,
in our culture, when new mothers deliver, they're treated like queens. They don't let them do anything. The mother-in-law, the family comes and they cook for her. They change they care for the child. She's in bed all the time.
The hospital staff is learning about their patients' traditional healing practices. Other medical centers are recognizing Natividad's work. Victor Sosa says he gets calls from hospitals in New York, Indiana, and Florida, hoping to find someone who can help doctors communicate with their indigenous patients from Mexico. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Salinas.
We've got photos of doctors and translators at Natividad. Check them out at our website, californiareport.org. Well, now a very different kind of translation, the Musical Instrument Digital Interface, MIDI for short. That's the software that lets computers and synthesizers talk to each other, and it's used by tens of millions of devices around the world. A guy named Dave Smith invented it 30 years ago. And you'd think someone who invented a language so elegant and so powerful would be well known, but few have heard of him. As KQED's Sci Musica reports, that could change when Smith gets a special Grammy Award for technical achievement this weekend in Los Angeles.
We're listening to the brakes on a garbage truck recorded by George Hurd and stored on his computer, and it's the perfect way to demonstrate the power of MIDI.
So essentially, you can turn any sound that exists into an instrument.
Hurd leads an up-and-coming electronic and acoustic ensemble in San Francisco. Listen to how he plays that break sound using a piano keyboard connected to his computer on a track recorded with his band.
So you're turning a garbage truck brake pad into an instrument and playing it with that keyboard.
Exactly.
And the MIDI software controlling the sound, even the 5-pin cable that transmits it, was developed 30 years ago. That's when Dave Smith and other music geeks were inventing the first digital synthesizers.
And we realized that for the small industry at the time to move forward, we really had to have some common way for all instruments to interconnect.
So Smith, who had his own company, Sequential Circuits, developed a universal interface with a few other synthesizer manufacturers.
Kind of a call to arms.
Smith tells me this story at his office in San Francisco's North Beach.
Well, if you want to do your dance music kind of sounds, you could do that.
As he shows off one of his newer synthesizers, Smith recalls how he demonstrated MIDI for the first time at a music convention in 1983. He connected one of his synths to one made by Roland with a cable, a MIDI connection, and played them both from his own machine. For a historic moment, it lacked drama.
Did people gather around? Did you draw a crowd?
There was a small crowd.
That's because few people understood what a big deal MIDI was. But it soon became the language with which all digital instruments communicated and the way computers record and generate digital sound. Think of Do, Re, Mi and how that eight-note scale is everywhere. MIDI is just as universal.
You hit a note, you hit middle C, and it sends out the information saying, play middle C. And then the other instruments will play middle C, or from a computer to one keyboard, or a computer can control three keyboards and each one could be playing a different part.
In an age when software and hardware change so fast, composer George Heard notes MIDI 1.0 is still the standard.
Which is just a ridiculous idea that the way the technology moves forward, that something can stay as it was when it was created so long ago, is a testament to how great an idea that it is.
Smith never made a penny off MIDI. It was the first open software. I asked him if he ever thought the Grammys would be honoring him for inventing it.
I never could have guessed that. In fact, I don't even think they had technical achievement Grammys 30 years ago. So it's kind of the consolation prize for not having any sort of royalty agreement for inventing MIDI.
Smith will get his special merit technical Grammy along with a Roland founder and keyboard engineer this weekend. For the California Report, I'm Cy Musiker.
And we've got some pictures of MIDI through the ages. Check out a timeline at californiareport.org. Well, when you think of romance on the beach, that scene in From Here to Eternity may come to mind. You know, where Burt Lancaster and Deborah Carr make out in the sand as waves crash over them? Well, a much, much less glamorous version of that is taking place now on California beaches. It's peak mating season for the northern elephant seal. KQED science reporter Lauren Sommer visited Año Nuevo State Reserve, where researchers are learning how the sounds males make help them score with the ladies.
Elephant seals spend most of the year alone out in the Pacific Ocean. So you can probably imagine what happens when they get together every winter.
Oh, well, that's mating behavior.
Naturalist Lisa Wolfplane is leading a public tour at Año Nuevo State Reserve, just north of Santa Cruz, where hundreds of elephant seals are packed together on a narrow strip of beach. Just in front of us, a male elephant seal has come up to a female, and, well, you get the idea.
You know, he's going after her. There he goes.
Now, if you're picturing an animal like a sea lion, think again. Male elephant seals are the size of an SUV, 15 feet long and 4,000 pounds. They have a huge fleshy nose that hangs over their mouth. Now, there are plenty of available females here, but most of these males will strike out. The dating scene is controlled by alpha males.
The alpha's strategy is to be dominant over a group of females, the harem, and they want to have the first kind of right to mate.
You can see the alpha males right in the middle of their group. Some have 10 females, some have 100. The rest of the males, the betas, are on the outskirts, just watching, waiting for their chance.
So this guy is coming in.
One has decided this is his moment. He moves quickly toward a female, faster than you might think for an animal with so much blubber. The alpha male perks up and answers with customary bravado. Sometimes the fight ends there, but not this one.
Now they're just hitting with their heads.
They lunge at each other, but a few strikes seem to be enough.
Now, yeah, he turned around and ran.
These fights can get bloody, and all the while, other males are taking advantage and sneaking in. It adds up to a very stressful time for male elephant seals.
It's not advantageous for males to fight all the time.
Carolyn Casey is a researcher at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She says fights are extremely risky.
Sometimes they can result in death, and we've seen that.
Plus, elephant seals don't eat while on land, so they have limited energy. Casey says, as with humans, one way to avoid fighting is communication. But until now, no one was really sure what the males were saying to each other. So she and her colleagues have been studying a small patch of beach with about 50 males.
We have come up with kind of this ranking system where we assign each male a score.
It's the same system used in professional sports. The males win or lose points with every fight. Casey says that's helped them see how communication fits in. Just take the example of one male elephant seal named X579.
His call to me is my favorite. He always has this really lovely note at the end of it.
X579 was a beta male with a lot of competition.
He tends to vocalize and challenge everybody right when he gets there.
He challenged an alpha named GL, who responded.
His call was very short. It was very to the point. That is what is so incredible. All of the animals sound completely different from one another.
What's more, each male uses the same call year after year, whether he has a harem or not. It's their signature call, and they flaunt it.
A larger, more dominant animal will come up to an animal, a smaller animal, maybe beat him up a little bit, call at him, you know, before and after, be like, hey, this is me. I'm Bob. Don't mess with me.
It's all about spreading your reputation around, she says.
That's called associative learning, and that's very unique among marine mammals. That means that every male has the potential to be learning every other male based on their acoustic signature at that site.
Casey says these complex communication systems have been studied in songbirds and other animals, but less is known about marine species.
I think it's just a piece of a larger puzzle in understanding kind of how these animals breed and ultimately how they're going to survive.
Elephant seals were hunted to near extinction for their blubber a century ago. Fewer than 100 were left off the coast of Mexico. With protective laws in place, today there are 170,000 northern elephant seals and growing. That's good news for Casey's loner elephant seal, X579. This year, he's an alpha male for the first time. Back at Año Nuevo, a few others aren't quite so lucky.
So here we have Pole Beach. It's a place where those that can't get any action are going to just hang out for the season.
Naturalist Lisa Wolfclane points to a group of male seals on what's been nicknamed Bachelor Beach. They've given up for now, but hey, there's always next year. For the California Report, I'm Lauren Summer at Año Nuevo State Reserve.
For a jazz musician, playing clarinet puts you outside the genre's mainstream right from the get-go. But Berkeley's Ben Goldberg has thrived on the margins for some three decades, making music rooted in his love of jazz, but always enriched by other practices and traditions. The California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert has this review of the clarinetist's two new albums.
In the mid-1980s, Berkeley clarinetist Ben Goldberg sparked the radical Jewish music movement with the New Klezmer Trio, a band combining avant-garde jazz's rambunctious improvisation with traditional Ashkenazi melodies. Dozens of ensembles walked through the door that he opened, most famously John Zorn's Masada, while Goldberg moved on to explore new musical avenues. In recent years, he's taken a highly lyrical turn, pursuing several projects setting text to music. While recorded 4 years apart, Goldberg's two new albums, Unfold Ordinary Mind and Subatomic Particle Homesick Blues, serve as fascinating milestones tracing his trajectory as an inspired tunesmith. That's Elliptical, the opening track from Unfold Ordinary Mind, a quintet session recorded last April. Featuring compositions clearly inspired by his recent immersion in songwriting, the album overflows with sinuous melodies. This piece, Stemwinder, wends its way for 9 minutes, building slowly to a crunching climax. Thank you. Looking at the album's personnel and knowing Goldberg's long history as a wizard of spontaneous composition, you might expect a session full of daredevil shredding. Nels Klein was LA's iconic underground guitar slinger before he added a bracing jolt of creative juice to Wilco. But Klein is always ready to wax lyrical, and he employs a lustrous, tawny tone that can turn bright and twangy on a dime. Part of what's fascinating about Unfold Ordinary Mind is that Goldberg spends much of the session serving rhythm section duties, playing bass lines on the imposing contra alto clarinet. It's a huge horn with a tree trunk thick sound. In Goldberg's hands, it can rumble like a subway underfoot or croon like Paul Robeson. I sometimes miss his exquisitely fluid B-flat clarinet, but with tenor saxophonists Rob Suddeth and Ellery Eskelin, Goldberg's tunes are rendered with all the requisite care. It's not hard to hear connections between Unfold and Subatomic Particle Homesick Blues, a mostly quintet session recorded in 2008, featuring trumpeter Ron Miles and saxophone star Joshua Redman, who sounds positively liberated in a rare stint as a sideman. Both albums dip into the controlled cadences of chamber jazz, then suddenly turn unruly. But where Unfold tends toward expansion and digression, Subatomic features 11 concise and focused tracks that sometimes stop mid-thought. Exploring a variety of moods and textures, Goldberg finds numerous ways to play with traditional jazz polyphony. The result is a charged version of 21st century West Coast jazz, full of careening, overlapping lines. An album this fun and eventful easily stands on its own. But together with Unfold Ordinary Mind, Subatomic Particle Homesick Blues traces the evolution of an artist who now seems to find beautiful melodies at the end of every path.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed Unfold Ordinary Mind and Subatomic Particle Homesick Blues by Ben Goldberg. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org, and of course, we're on Facebook, too. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Rob Spaeth. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. Craig Miller was a contributing editor. The associate senior producer is Victoria Malione. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, with nomination information about the 2014 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards available at www.irvine.org. The California Endowment, health happens with prevention at calendow.org. And Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education. More information available at chevron.com.